Welcome to The Hobcast, a weekly podcast from Hoback Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of building a new creative business in this pandemic world. We'll hear from the people who make all this possible, the authors, cover designers, and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on The Hobcast from Hoback Books, as we combined trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello.
Hello, and welcome to The Hobcast Book Show. It is episode 83.
It is indeed episode 83.
And if you're only just joining us at episode 83, what have you missed? Well, you've missed...
loads!
Yeah, it's just tons. But some of the greatest authors on the planet have been part of this show.
And they've missed us.
They have. Yeah, well, okay, we're just
the flim flam.
We're the bread in the sandwich. The real juice, let's be honest, is the interviews.
Can we be homemade crusty?
If you want. I mean, I haven't managed to succeed to make crusty in a gluten-free bread
Not
yet.
Not quite, yeah, no.
Okay, well, we're digressing already. Let me explain who we are, or us explain who we are. My name is Adrian Hobart.
And my name is Rebecca Collins.
Together we run Hoback Books, and we are UK independent publishers of the following four genres:
mystery,
crime,
thrillers,
and suspense. And we've been going
ages.
We've been publishing for 2 years this month when we first published Robert Dawes.
Yes.
And in that time, we have attracted no less than 22 authors. We have now released 52 books.
Did you count?
Yeah, I did.
Well done.
Yeah. I did it only this week, actually. I was in conversation with Anthony Dunford, and I figured it out. In fact, between us, we did it. I mean, I can't claim to have the maths to be able to put it together, but we did it together.
You can't claim to have the maths to count.
No. It's an issue. I can't remember what the name is for numerical dyslexia, but it's pretty much me. I personify it. So,
and I think I have a form of dyslexia to do with following instructions and directions, because there is a form of dyslexia.
Is there really?
Yes.
Is that why it explains why you always get lost whenever you go to Telford?
Yeah, it's a form of dyslexia.
Yeah. I mean, admittedly, Telford looks much the same wherever you are, and the only landmarks to work with are a roundabout with a bunch of field guns.
Oh, the gun roundabout, yeah.
The gun roundabout near Donington Barracks. The Asda on the outskirts.
Which is really difficult. Oh, there's two Asdas. There's one right in the centre.
Yeah, just to make life very confusing. I don't know why we're talking about Telford. Anyway, Telford is not that far from where we are based at Hoback Books and Hoback Towers. And it's
a black hole.
A little bit, yeah.
I mean, I actually sent you a text message, didn't I, recently? And I said, I can't escape Telford. I tried.
Yeah, it's difficult. And, you know, geographically, they have a very big feature nearby called the Wrekin, which is a big lump of hill.
And there is actually a local saying, mm-hmm, to go round the Wrekin. Do you know what that means? If I said to you, oh, you're going round the Wrekin again.
You're going mad?
No. Oh, he doesn't know.
You're going a bit Bodmin?
No, you're just a bit like what we do on this podcast, talking about all sorts of stuff without actually getting to the nuts and bolts.
Right, we're doing a good job of that. I did start this week by saying to Rebecca and you know, basically reminding myself that we want to get this program into a format that is less than an hour. But somehow we always fail to do so. And we've had another really big interview this week. Well, I mean, lengthy, I should say, with April Doyle, who's our guest. And she has recently had success with her novel Hive, which is a speculative fiction novel. We'll talk more about what that's all about later. And it was shortlisted for the Excellent Novel Prize. So it was a really good interview. Lovely.
And April persuaded you to buy a book.
Yeah, she did. And in fact, it's down there.
It's down there, yeah.
Christopher Vogler's The Writer's Journey.
Yeah. It's quite a weighty tome, doesn't it? Tome? Is that the word?
Tome.
Tome. Tome. No, I've been saying tome all my life.
Oh, my goodness. Right. No, it's a tome. Anyway, it's a whopper. I'll look forward to skimming it.
Well, I see it's strategically placed next to the pink chair. Now, the pink chair, for people who don't know about our pink chair, is the chair that whoever's watching TV or playing on the Xbox, they sit in, because it's right in front of the TV.
Mm-hmm.
And so this afternoon, you've got some sport to watch, haven't you?
I do. I have a Grand Prix to watch, and I have Man United's last pre-season game.
So I'd like to see you dipping in and out of the writer's journey during the boring bits of the sport.
Pretty much all of it, I should think. Anyway, we'll hold out hope that it's George Russell on pole position for the first time in his career.
How about Pogba? That's exciting.
He doesn't play for Man United anymore. We don't talk about him anymore.
Oh no! So racing, yes.
Yeah.
George Russell. He's one of the.
I'd love to see Pogba on the front row of a grid and
see
what he does with a car.
I want Max Verstappen.
Hopefully, he wraps it around a lamppost. Anyway, yeah, I know you want Mac. He's 10th on the grid, which is a disaster for him. So, anyway, we digress as ever. We'll get into some news. First of all, I want to congratulate. I think we should congratulate AB Morgan, Alison Morgan, on the release of her third Quirks story.
Yeah. So novel. Last week on Tuesday, the third installment in the Quirk Adventures.
Quirk Files, actually, is what we call it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and it's had a lot of love. It's been really good, actually. She was on a blog tour, but not just the blog tour. I've had lots of people say, "Oh, wonderful, another Quirk book. I love the other two." And also people who've come to it fresh saying, "Right, I've just bought the other two now because I loved it so much." They've gone back and.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's been terrific. So, Verity Vanishes is the third of the Quirk Files. And it's a mix of dark humour, a little bit cosy, a beautiful relationship between Pedder and Connie Quirk, who are private investigators. They are great books.
And there's a cat in it.
Yep. And they're all available on audio, all a bit audible, as usual, taking their time to get their act together and publish the thing. But, we'll give them 6 months. That usually happens before then. But congratulations. And you had a little launch, Ali, I know.
At the local.
Which I always snigger whenever I say the name of the pub because it's called The Cock. And that looked good.
And actually, last week we gave away 10 free audio downloads, didn't we, of Verity Vanishes?
Yeah.
So we are going to do another giveaway for AB Morgan. We're going to do Throttled.
Okay, well, it's the second in the series, yeah.
But later on in this podcast.
Okay, so listen out for that. We've got some giveaway codes. And no doubt we'll do that after we've spoken to April. Let's get into a little bit of news, which is the stuff that's pertinent to our end of the, or, you know, the publishing industry in wider sense, because, you know, we don't work in a sort of vacuum. But
feels like it sometimes.
Well, it does feel a bit like that. But I mean, there was one story that has affected us directly in terms of business that you've got there, and this is the story: the UK's number one book chain, Waterstones,
yes,
changed their warehousing and computer systems quite recently.
Yes, yeah,
and so it's caused havoc.
So basically, it's a warehouse management system. So basically how they coordinate their warehousing and distribution. And it's just had lots of teething problems. And it's caused a certain amount of chaos, as you say. We had a little bit of an issue. It was Brian Price's books getting into his local Waterstones. They ordered them, heard nothing for ages. And eventually they did get the books. But this is quite a long article, actually. There's a lot of people quite upset about this, authors and publishers. So apparently one indie publisher said they've had huge problems. It's not us. In fact, one of their authors went to the Theakston's Old Peculiar Crime Writing Festival, hoping that while they were there, they could go to a load of the local shops to sign their new book. But they couldn't because even though the book had published, it wasn't in any of the Waterstones. Not because they hadn't wanted to stock it, they just hadn't got the stock.
No. I mean, basically, the supply chain has broken down and it's affected a lot of publishers, not just ourselves in a very small way, but some of the biggest publishers are moaning about it. So, yeah, I mean, how many times do we hear this about changes to computer systems bringing problems? It never goes smoothly, does it?
I think it's one of the major problems with anything like this is these things are done too quickly.
Yeah.
And so if something is done too quickly and they haven't considered all the possibilities of what could go wrong, when something goes wrong, they can't cope with it because they haven't thought about what.
Yeah. Well, we in ourselves had, this is nothing to do with Waterstones, but even with the launch of Verity Vanishes, we had our usual thing. I mean, one in three books that we've published through Amazon have had problems with the paperbacks, it feels like, recently.
More than we used to, yeah. Yes. So it was basically where they challenge whether we have the rights. I don't know, something in their system crops up a duplication. I think it might be because Alison has books published.
Yeah, by other publishers, yeah.
So, because it does seem to happen with any of our authors who are either self-published or have books published elsewhere. So it did happen, inevitably. And
it happens right on the eve of publication, you know, literally, actually on the day of publication. So it's saying it's out of stock. So we had, well, you had a probably 48-hour period of trying to get this straightened out, maybe even 72 hours, I don't know.
Part of the problem was that we had photographs of the documentation we needed to prove it, but the reply came back saying, your photographs are not good enough quality, please resend.
Yeah.
So, you know, and these things take time because there's time between each reply.
Well, each time we've managed to resolve the situation, but I mean, someone who's been worked with us in the past, Matt Holmes, who we've had on the podcast talking about Amazon ads and advertising in general. His wife's latest book had 2,500 pre-orders, which is an amazing number. Fantastic. Would have probably taken it straight to the top of whichever chart. But Amazon cancelled the pre-order, and all of those orders were lost.
Now, that did happen to us once.
Yes, it happens to us once,
but
yeah.
Luckily, it wasn't quite
that sort of number.
No, because it's quite early on in our publishing career.
But, you know, these are the trip hazards that lie in wait for all publishers. But for small independent publishers or self-publishers, you know, it can be catastrophic. Let's be honest. That's a lot of work's probably gone into getting that number of pre-orders, which is a fantastic achievement.
But it happened to someone like Simon McLeave as well, didn't it?
Yes, it did. Yeah. Yes, it did. Yeah, quite recently. And again, very costly. I mean, just think of the revenue that would generate. 2,500 pre-orders.
I think the worst thing, though, is the embarrassment because hopefully the customers will still order.
But how do you reach them all? No, you don't know.
Amazon emails everybody.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it says your order's been cancelled. But it's the embarrassment.
Yeah. I mean, that's dreadful. Anyway, let's get off that subject of supply. So Waterstone's still trying to work through their snags. This is one that caught my eye, and caught both our eyes, really, about the growth of union membership in British publishing. Now, the staff of HarperCollins in the US are going on strike because of cost of living issues and lack, you know, and the sort of pay increases they've had recently, or not. And there is a report in the Bookseller that's talking about how a number of publishers have finally started to recognise union membership within their workforce. Mm. And this has been a long set of negotiations. So the unions involved are the NUJ, the National Union of Journalists, and Unite, who are one of the biggest, in fact they are the biggest, I believe, of all the unions covering many, many industries. And gradually membership has grown. And I think that, you know, this is an interesting phenomena because, look, being a member of the NUJ is not cheap. I used to be one, and even the lowest rate, it's a good wedge of money. I mean, it's 25 quid a month or something like that. And so that would suggest to me that given the numbers that have joined from the publishing industry, that there really is a problem. I mean, publishing has always been for many of the entry-level jobs and the sort of, even the ones for professionals who've been in the business maybe 5 or 10 years, the pay has been terrible.
Yeah, I wasn't paid masses when I was there, I worked full time.
No, and indeed freelancers, again, a similar problem. So there is clearly a mood changing. But I have a word of caution. I mean, I'm not anti-unions at all, but I would say my experience with the NUJ was not positive when I needed help. It was just brushed away, you know, saying, well, you know, we've got other priorities. And when it's an individual, you're paying your subs, you've been a member for a decade or whatever it was that I'd been a member, you don't expect to just get brushed off when, you know, you're facing a career, you know, in my case, the end of my broadcasting career. And, you know, and I felt unjustly. And so, you know, but I got no representation whatsoever when it boiled down to it. So, I think that the principle of unions on a macro level works.
Yes, I was about to say that's a macro thing, isn't it?
Yeah, but when it comes down to individual stuff and disputes, I mean, there are lots of them within the BBC. There are just hundreds of them going on, and they're just choosing to fight the ones which fit their political spectrum. And I was a man. Yes, absolutely, 100%. You know, they're picking and choosing, and that shouldn't be the case with the union, I don't think. I mean, if you've got a member who's got a problem, they should help you to sort it out.
It could be a resources thing, though. If you said there were loads of...
Well, yeah, there is an element of that, but I think there's also a political choice. You know, what basically they'll fight the ones which make the point they're trying to make, in a wider sense. Do you see what I mean? Rather than the actual... So, yeah, I would say I was disappointed. But there's a lot of growth. For instance, the NUJ said there were 25 Bloomsbury members a year ago, and now 70 are members from Bloomsbury's. Which is, you know, it's interesting.
That is quite significant, actually, because Bloomsbury may seem like a really big company, but it isn't. I've been to the offices. It's not as big as you'd think it is.
No, I mean, it's a big name, but they have just launched a new company-wide bonus scheme of 6% of annual salary, which was added to employees' June salary, combined with an annual pay rise of 5%. That's a one-off, the 6% one. But, I mean, that's not insignificant.
No. I mean, I think Bloomsbury are actually very clever because I think they do try and keep on top of things that could happen.
Yeah.
And they've always done that. And I think that's the secret of their success in many ways.
True. And the final story we wanted to touch on in this section of the show is to do with Meta. That is to say...
Metadata or metaphysics?
No. Meta, the parent company of Facebook, Instagram and... you know, all those sort of platforms.
Hey.
And we're basically talking about Facebook. And they have reported, again, a big drop in revenue because people are moving away from advertising on Facebook adverts because subscriber numbers have dropped again, which is still got 3.6 billion people. Half the world's population are on Facebook. So it's not the end of the world. The biggest problem they've got in terms of their profits falling is that they've spent an absolute fortune trying to create something called the metaverse, where they are trying to combine all of their platforms and then take it to another level where everyone sort of exists in the metaverse. I mean, goodness. I mean, basically, it's a very ill-defined, unexplained thing they're trying to do, and it's costing them a lot of money. But nonetheless, the market has reacted to say, you know, the skids are under these platforms at the moment. You know, the advertisers are pulling their spend out. And, you know, we've said this for several months now. From our perspective, the impact and value that Facebook ads now offer is very low.
It's very sporadic in
yes.
our experience.
It's very hard to predict. It's got, you know, it used to be, you know, almost, you know, you could put some systematic thinking behind it and it would work.
Mm.
But now... it's very patchy, but you know it's still an important plank. But we are focusing more on Amazon ads as it stands.
And yes,
made that transition. Yeah. So you know, interesting times ahead. But the magic bubble of Facebook and Meta and Mark Zuckerberg is slipping. And another big pressure for them. There are two other things that we've mentioned before plenty of times, is the fact that more and more platforms, like Google, like Apple. Are withdrawing or giving users more options to withhold their data. And that is what Facebook relies on, is being able to see what you're up to, what you're thinking about, what you're doing. And they still, of course, you know, you've all seen this if you're on Facebook, adverts popping up because you had a conversation with somebody about such and such and suddenly an advert for it turns
up. It happens
up.
To me all the time.
Yeah, which
I was talking about wetsuits with my sister.
Yeah.
And seriously.
As you do.
And then and an advert did pop up not that long after.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there you go. I mean, we are being monitored. I mean, everything we do online is being monitored. But increasingly, you can opt out of things. And this is a big problem for Facebook. So that's one thing. And then there's the growing movement across the world to regulate these digital social media platforms more heavily. And, it, you know, when it boils down to it, no one's really had the courage to do it yet at a governmental level. They're all talking a good game. It will happen eventually, but no one's had the courage yet to do it. And as we mentioned last week, you know, or a week before that, perhaps, you know, it's a little galling that some of these companies that are making billions are hardly paying any tax in the countries where they're making the money.
That is a big hump.
It is a big hump. Less of a hump is our interview with April. If we can get to that now.
Yeah, we can. I think so.
Okay,
think
give me the nod. Give me the nod. Good.
I give him the nod.
Well, April Doyle is a very experienced creative writing teacher. She's based in Kent, but her first published novel, Hive, has come out to great acclaim. It is speculative fiction in the sense that it's looking to a world in the not-too-distant future where bees and pollinators in general have declined to such an extent that the world's facing a crisis.
So we do talk about bees quite a lot.
We do. We do talk about bees. There's a real buzz around this interview.
Bzz.
You're supposed to go kdunch. That was a terrible joke. April was also shortlisted for, with this book, Hive, for the Exeter Novel Prize, which is extremely prestigious. So congratulations to her. But it's a really good interview talking about, you know, not just what inspired her behind this book, but the craft, because she has helped so many people in a creative writing sense and other authors. And so there's a lot of thought here. And we had a great time. So this is April Doyle. April Doyle, thank you so much for joining us on the Hobcast Book Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've got so much we want to ask you. But first of all, let's put you in context in terms of your book to date, Hive. Tell us about the thinking behind that. We love speculative fiction, but boy, it can be dark at times. So your book is based on the presumption that bees are disappearing fast.
Yes, yeah. Well, bees and pollinators generally, which is actually happening, which makes this even more scary.
Yeah.
So it's a near future imagining of what might happen if the bees and pollinators continue to decline. You know, the knock-on effects that's going to have for food and society. And it focuses on a quite a disparate group of characters who have to work together to make it work, to help them to survive. And it's focusing on quite a small area. I've set it here in Kent.
Yeah.
So it's a smallish group of characters all based in Kent who have to try and find a solution to this terrible problem of no pollinators. And there are other elements as well. I don't want to give any spoilers, but there are other sort of elements that work against them as we move through the book.
Absolutely. What a great place to set it. I mean, in the sense, it's your home county, but Kent, the Garden of England, for those who don't know.
Well, that's
right. I have a question because there was somebody posed a question on, I don't know if you're aware of you might not be aware, there's a Facebook group called the UK Crime Book Club. So this is basically fans of crime fiction, and it's quite a big group. Mm-hmm. Somebody put the question on there the other day saying, how important is it that the author's been to the place where they set their book? And I just want to know how you feel about that, because you've obviously set your book, even though it's sort of near future, it's not quite as things are now, but it's, you know the area because you live there. So was that important to you to set it somewhere you could feel and sense yourself?
I mean, interestingly, I didn't originally, the first draft wasn't set in Kent. It was set on the west coast of America in California, which is where the commercial bee farmers predominantly work. They set off with huge lorry loads of beehives, and they set them out. They start in the almond orchards, and then they work as the season progresses. They work their way gradually east across the United States with the bees pollinating the crops, and they sort of work across. And that was much more of a kind of big budget thriller, you know, with the FBI, and it was quite a broad story, and I loved it actually. But I spoke to someone who suggested that mine, if it was just kind of scaled down a little bit, would get more of the characters working together. It would be more intimate. We'd see that struggle. And also the relationship with the bees could be closer and more intimate. And I think that really worked. I think it made a stronger book. So I haven't started answering your question yet. So yeah, so I did that. And let's see, I think all the other books I've written have been set in places where I've lived or worked or visited on holiday before. But I mean, what if you wanted to set a book on Mars or something? I don't think you should be limited by having visited the places that you have been. And I think with Google these days, it's so easy to, you know, virtually visit places. and to research different climates and cultures. And I don't think that should be a limit.
No, I would agree with you. And I think there were a lot of lockdown writers, you know, famous authors who were relying on Google research because they couldn't get out. And I'm thinking of Robert Harris with V2 was written during lockdown, and that was all sort of internet research and book research as opposed to actually being physically in the launch sites for V2 rockets and that sort of thing. So but I think that there's no less legitimacy in my book for doing it the way that one would do it, you know, in terms of nowadays, at least.
No, I agree to some extent. And somebody actually commented and said, well, my books are urban fantasy, so the place is in my head. Does that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And I said, well, it's a real place to you. It's in your imagination. So it's as real as visiting the town, a real town that you're writing about.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, that's a really good point, actually. Yes, if your imagination is vivid enough to make it real to you, then you should be able to make it real to other people.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, even if you are dealing with a real place that you know, I mean, you can still, as an author, you still have a big challenge trying to decide which details you need to include, what aspects. I mean, you know, quite a few writers will do the visual thing. In fact, probably all of us concentrate on the visual. That's and the ones that really stand out are the ones who can make the place smell a certain thing, and, you know, get your saliva going, you know, or your heart racing, or your skin prickling because of the heat and all that sort of stuff. I mean, I think that the really gifted authors can do all of that without perhaps ladling on too much description. So it's there's an art to it. I'm very interested in the point you made about the relationship with bees. Now, that strikes me as something, you know, whenever I see a bee, we saw some yesterday.
We played tennis yesterday.
There were a bumble, I don't know.
With bees?
Technically types of bees they were. But
they were definitely bumblebees, weren't they?
They were bumblebees, yeah.
Sleepy bees, because they were on the ground.
Right. But, you know, there I am with this sort of twin feeling towards them. First of all, I get the message about the importance of bees and pollinators, and so I have an empathy for them. But at the same time, I'm thinking, I don't want to, A, tread on one, A, to kill one, but B, please don't sting me. Yeah. So there is this twin, they appeal to me, but at the same time, I'm wary of them. What about how your characters interact with bees?
Yes, well, the two main characters, one of them is a research entomologist. So her life revolves around bees, and they're sort of her subjects, but she feels more deeply for them than that. She watches them every day. Really, her life is her bees, and so she's very closely connected with them. And then Victor, who's the commercial bee farmer, has a more emotional response to them. I think he's more naturally drawn to them and has a more natural affinity with them. So they're not, it's not a science project for him. It's his life. But his wife, strangely, doesn't like bees. She doesn't like the crawling and the kind of unpredictable nature of them. She's supportive, but she's not keen. And then there's another character. He is very keen on ecology in all its forms. He's a presenter. He writes, there are chapters of his throughout the book talking about bees and the books he's written and the wide travel that he's done all over the place, looking at different bees in different places. So I think he's more interested in them from a purely scientific point of view, whereas the others seem to have more of an emotional connection.
Yeah. Well, that's quite an interesting contrast, isn't it? I mean, you get that in all sorts of aspects of life, don't you? The sort of very logical scientific view and then the emotional view. And but people do tend to think that the scientific one is more valid than the emotional one.
Well, Victor, the bee farmer, he is really in tune with his bees. He talks to them. And I think a lot of beekeepers talk to their bees. That's something that, you know, throughout the generations, people talk to their bees. And I think you're supposed to tell your bees if someone dies in the family and things like that. You're supposed to keep them informed of what's going on. And he's a little bit like that. He talks to them.
It's a fascinating subject. The question that's burning in my mind at the moment, and this is a bit flippant, I'm sorry, but bees get a bad rap. And I have to blame Michael Caine for giving them a bad rap.
You have to give bees a bad rap as Michael Caine.
Okay, well, I mean, everyone knows The Swarm. It's his worst movie. It's the one where he made, you know, he always says, sort of, I made it because it bought my mother a house or something like that.
Yeah.
I think he was, or it paid the school fees or something. Mm. There's a scene where he basically, it's in the trailer if you look it up on YouTube, but he goes, it's the bees, it's the bloody bees or something like that. You know? Get inside and all that stuff. And, and he's kind of a split character because he's got that sort of, he's got to try and defend humanity against this swarm of killer African bees.
But I think it's the swarm aspect, isn't
it? He's also sympathetic. He's a scientist. He appreciates their importance, but, you know.
I think as humans, we fear anything that swarms.
Yeah, we do.
Because we think it's a threat.
Yes, well, it's a perfectly natural instinct. And also, we know they can sting us and they can cause us pain. So I think it's perfectly natural and normal to be a bit wary about bees and wasps and other stinging things.
Yeah. Now, in terms of your writing career, you're a creative writing teacher.
Yes, I'm a sort of part-time freelance creative writing teacher. I did write teach for a adult education project, which sadly closed down, but my writer said that they wanted to sort of carry on with me, so we've picked up and carried on. My proper day job is office work, but that's what pays the bills, but my love is the writing.
That's fantastic.
I think so many writers live a life like that. They have the day job and then the passion that they pursue when they can. So
yeah.
But the question that rises in my mind is that, I mean, we've talked to Lee Russell, who was also doing some creative writing teaching alongside the authorial career. Mm. I always feel this is probably why I've chickened out doing it, but if you are teaching at the same time you're writing books, there is a certain, you can talk the talk, but can you walk the walk? Did you ever get that sort of feeling about, you know, how my pupil's going to perceive my writing when I finish book?
I don't know if I've ever really worried about that, but I have on occasions when I've been feeling disheartened about writing and thought about maybe, you know, is this something I really want to carry on with? This is difficult. This is a difficult road I'm on here. I have thought then, how does that translate to being a creative writing teacher, which I do desperately want to carry on with?
Yeah.
You know, and I sort of feel like I do have to keep on walking the walk in some capacity, you know, and so that's something that helps me to keep going if I am having a dark moment. You know, I just really want to carry on with the writing and the practice of it, because yes, how can I really teach if I'm not trying to do it myself?
I think that's very true, because when I did a master's in fine art, and all the lecturers were practicing artists as well. Mm. So, and you did get that feeling of, you know, they do it themselves. They know what it's like. It might be very different to what I was doing, but it sort of gives them that weight behind what they're teaching, knowing that they do it themselves. And
also the writing feeds into the teaching and the teaching feeds into the writing. There are all kinds of things that I have researched, you know, read up on, prepared for creative writing lessons, that's opened my eyes to the craft of writing hugely, and it sort of keeps me on my toes in terms of keeping up with you know, the arguments that writers have with each other online, and, you know, discussions about is creative writing a valid discipline, is that something that can be taught, or do you know how to do it instinctively, or, you know, there's lots of things that are always being talked about, and also the craft side of things, like structure and characterization, things like that. I've looked into it much more deeply as a tutor than I think I would have if it was just me writing alone.
Yeah, I think that's interesting, because you know, often with writers it is instinctual, and it's only when the edit comes in, it slaps you in the face, and you know, you realize that structurally it didn't quite work, or you know, you've missed out something that the reader needs or something like that. But when you are teaching, I mean, I presume with adult learners, you're talking about people perhaps whose command of English, written English, is perhaps not as developed as other people. Is that correct? When you pick them up, or?
Yeah, I think when I was teaching on the adult education program, we had a very diverse range of people joining. Some people had been writing for a long time. You know, I've got students who've done creative writing MAs, and they just want to keep up. Well, they're in the middle of a project, and it's attending the classes kind of helps to motivate them to keep writing.
Yeah.
And then we had people who were picking it up for the first time, maybe people who were looking to develop a skill, or they tried writing in the past and been discouraged by English teachers, or, you know, just lots and lots of different examples, which made it really interesting as a creative writing tutor, because you never know who's going to turn up on the day. And in terms of how you present things to a class, where there's that full range of people, that was amazing.
Oh, yeah. Actually,
it was a really good challenge.
And they'd get to learn off each other as well, wouldn't they? Yeah. From each other. And
yes, and share.
Yeah, no, that's brilliant. I suppose the challenge in some ways is actually breaking down what's instinctual to oneself, and then being able to express that clearly, so that it has a sort of practical way forward for people who don't feel or have that instinct.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. I mean, the group that I've got with me now, who've been following along for the last couple of years or so, they're all what I would class as, you know, committed writers who are they're either doing it for pleasure, or they're trying to get published, or, you know, they've got a project in mind. And so I think we've sort of boiled down to a group of quite serious writers now, which is lovely, and it feels like a really nice safe space in which to share work. I think it's really difficult, I know myself, to share writing, if particularly if you've had a bad experience in the past with, you know, negative feedback or people not being encouraging. But it feels now that we've got a lovely, lovely group of, yeah, writers who want to share and want to learn. It's really nice. It's the best part of my week.
So in terms of the way that your writing has developed and teaching and leading these groups, how much have you learned from those other people in terms of things, you know, have you had that acceptance and adaptation as a result of doing the teaching?
I don't share my work as part of the class. It's because,
right,
I feel like that's not what people haven't come to hear me read my stuff.
No, okay.
Tell me what they think about it. Occasionally, if we have a sharing class, you know, at the end of the term, maybe we'll all read out a little bit of something, but then that's not for critique, that's just purely for the love of listening to each other.
Yeah.
But I definitely, I mean, I learn a lot from other writers' work, just different styles, different approaches. I've taught some amazingly gifted writers who would, you know, I give out writing prompts and we write for 10 minutes or 15 minutes and they read back their first draft and it absolutely blows me away sometimes. I love those prompt writing times.
Yes,
people are just free writing, and it really feels like sort of magic in the room. Everyone's just got their heads down scribbling away, and I try and join in with the writing times as well, because it feels like that's a space where, you know, I could have some ideas as well.
True enough. No, it's wonderful. And if you were picking out one piece of advice that, you know, is a staple of yours to your group, is there anything that you give out as a regular thing? Because for us, we catch ourselves saying to our authors, have you read this out loud?
Yeah, that's a big
that's,
one, isn't it?
That's the one where, you know, especially for submissions, read it out loud, because you'll see where we're thinking it's a bit clunky, or it's the dialogue hasn't flowed or worked.
Yeah.
So, you know, have you got one thing that, you know, is your staple that you will always give out?
I think, well, something that I find myself saying a lot is about the rules of writing, because people will say things about, you know, it's show don't tell and things like that. And I always try to say that I think it's more about having a toolkit, like a toolbox of writing, so you know how to show when you need to show, but you also know how to tell, because sometimes you do need to tell, and you know how to write from various different points of view, and you understand what narrative distance means and kind of zooming in and out on the character.
Yeah.
And you know, just an understanding, a general understanding of structure. And I think these are all tools that you have in your writerly toolkit. And I just try to advise that, you know, don't worry about the rules. As long as you know how to do all these things, then you can decide for your piece of writing what's the best, you know, what tool you need. And there might be some tools you never use that just end up at the bottom of the toolkit, and there are ones that you'll use all the time.
I like that though. Well, I think it's very visual, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think that's right. I think I always say to our authors, or actually to many of our guests on this program, I say, is there one aspect of your writing that you're trying to improve in the next book? Because there's always some, everyone has a gift for hopefully a few of the bits of the toolkit, but certainly,
everyone has a weakness, don't they? I think.
Well, someone will stand out for X, and it might be the dialogue is not as strong as the rest of the work they do, so that's something to think about. Or their pacing might be off, or that sort of stuff. Or the characterization, they might not be as descriptive and give people an impression of the people they're dealing with and they're reading about, and that they could strengthen that.
Yes. Yeah, something else that's just occurred to me is speech tags, use of speech tags. That's quite a contentious subject, isn't it?
Yes.
Do we just use he said, she said, or can we use, shouted, screamed, expostulated?
Well, where do you stand on that debate? Because it's my number one bugbear.
Yeah, this is...
Because Stephen King in On Writing has...
Wonderful book.
It's a great book, but that one piece of advice about, he said, she said, is all you need. Trust me, as a narrator... of audiobooks, it is the last thing you need, because yes, it's for a reader in a physical copy or an ebook, your eyes do skip over that he said, she said, no problem at all, because your brain just eliminates them. It just says they're not there. But in an audiobook, they slap you in the face.
Okay, wow.
Yeah. Because it's quite repetitive, isn't it?
It's so
repetitive style.
You can have hundreds of the damn things in a book. And all you've got to do with an, you've got A, there are no clues. I do apologize.
Is it Stephen King?
Yeah. Sorry, Stephen.
Probably. No. I think, he's a great writer and knows his, he's, goodness knows. I mean, one of the greats. But that advice, I think, is so limiting. But at the same time, there is a balance to strike, because some people throw in a bunch of adverbs and then shouted angrily or whatever it
was. Yes,
might be.
Yeah.
And it should be obvious from the dialogue, exactly, which I think is what he's trying to say.
Yeah.
So I'm sort of an ambivert on this subject, in the sense that I can see the value of what he says, but at the same time, I don't want to be stuck with that. And as a narrator, there's nowhere to go with it, because it is such a slap. It is literally feels like a slap in the face every time you say he says, she said, repeatedly in a scene.
I can imagine. Yeah.
And I'm going to throw you another, if there was one question, is there's one book that you go back to for your pupils and your group, or for yourself, which one is it in terms of its value as a guide to the craft?
Oh, there's lots. So there's On Writing, Stephen King On Writing, as you mentioned. There's Big Magic by Elizabeth Gilbert, which is so amazing.
That's on my wish list.
It's amazing.
My Amazon wish list, yeah.
Get it.
She also does a podcast I just discovered this week, so I'm working my way. It's called Magic Lessons.
She's very good, isn't she? She's very sharp.
Yeah. There's Bird by Bird by Anne Lamott, which is, again... It's not so much about the craft of writing, it's approaching writing and creativity and not being afraid, not being put off by one's own perfectionism and all the little things that we do to ourselves to stop ourselves from getting on with it. It's a gentle encouragement, it's an arm around the shoulder, and I need that a lot. There's John York, Into the Woods.
And yes. We have two copies of that.
Yes.
And The Heroes, I
know the one you mean. Yeah.
Not The Hero's Journey.
Let's talk about future projects, April.
Yeah, what are you working on now?
Well, I've got a book that's out with agents at the minute, which is a rom-com. I changed direction because so many agents said to me how it was quite depressing, the book I'd written, and they didn't think people were going to want to read it. But anyway, I did keep going with the submission, and here we go. It's out anyway.
Yeah, what do they know?
Well, I mean, there seems to be quite a market for dystopian books. So, but I slightly changed direction. So I've written a rom-com about two romantic novelists. And now I'm just starting another rom-com, because it is more fun to write. I have to say that after writing Hive, I'm so aware of the bees and climate change. I mean, we all are, aren't we? Because it's a thing. It's happening now. But I think Hive has made me more aware. Yeah. So I think I'm just going to give myself a little break with a couple of rom-coms, and then we'll see if another dystopian idea comes along.
We ought to get to the highlight of any interview with the Hobcast, which of course is the point where I go
that.
Very deep and you say something bizarre. So
embracing.
Here we go.
Yeah.
Good luck, April. Good luck. It's been lovely speaking to you.
but
our friendship may be over after this. Here we go.
Honestly, it's not that bad.
All right, you say that. We'll be the judge. We'll be the judge. Rebecca's random question.
As always, these questions come to me randomly, and this one came to me while I was lying in bed this morning watching Neighbours, interestingly enough, but it's not about Neighbours. I would like to know, which is your favourite fairy tale and why?
Oh my goodness, I know the answer to this one.
Brilliant.
It's The Little Mermaid by Hans Christian Andersen.
Right.
Not the Disney version, the original. No. Yeah, the original kind of unrequited.
It's quite dark and
version.
Dystopian, isn't it? As a fairy
it
tale.
Is. It is. Yeah. Why? I don't know. Maybe I liked it because it didn't have a happy ending.
Yeah.
Yeah. It wasn't a traditional pattern of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that doesn't make me sound too disturbed because.
But about it, a lot of them were. I mean, yeah. Especially Hans Christian Andersen ones, they were a bit dystopian and disturbing.
The Grimm's fairy tales. I mean, they someone always suffered in those. I mean, they're quite dark. It's like Doctor Who, you know, it's pretty dark, but at the end they kind of resolve it reasonably happily.
Yeah, I think the term fairy tale is a bit misleading, actually, because there's a lot of darkness in them.
There's a lot of darkness and grisliness.
No, that's a good one.
Do you have one?
Do I have one? Yeah, I guess I've always loved the Three Little Pigs. I don't know what it is about that. Or Little Red Riding Hood's quite fun.
Yeah, it's a good one. I think mine was Hansel and Gretel.
Oh yeah.
Oh, the house, the edible house. Yes, yeah. That's a good one, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, I think anything involving food is is up there. I mean, that speaks to me. So. Yeah.
So well, this whole idea of children wanting happy stories.
I think it's, you know, I think that their appetite for fear is huge. Mm. And for Jeopardy. I mean, they love it.
They love Jeopardy.
As a child of the 70s, watching Tom Baker's Doctor Who, which was really gothic in the first three seasons, really, really gothic.
I still can't watch Doctor Who because of Tom Baker and the Daleks.
Yeah, same here. I used to hide behind the sofa. Mm.
They took it to places which are, you know, that you would have to be after the watershed now in terms of the level of malevolence, dystopia, death, all sorts. And thematically, there are other qualms that people now have because you had Anglo actors doing Chinese characters in Talents of Weng Chiang and things like that, which would be completely unacceptable nowadays, but and should have been unacceptable then, let's be honest. But nonetheless, I still get a frisson, even though I know what's going to happen.
But it seems like the eyes of these things, like Tom Baker did have quite spooky eyes himself, but I remember that everyone remembers this, the one with the train.
The train, where he gets his foot stuck.
Yes. It gives me the EBGB.
That's the deadly assassin. Yeah. Sorry, I'm showing my geekiness now. There was a scene in that where Tom Baker, this is Mary Whitehouse, had her complaints upheld, I think.
Oh, really?
There's a bit where Tom Baker is being drowned in that in a battle with the master, and you know, some sort of avatar for the master. And he gets his head pushed under the water, and this guy says, you know, die, doctor, die. And you know, it's all the things the producer's guidelines don't let you do anymore. Pre-watershed. Mm. It's all there at 5:25 on a Saturday afternoon. I mean, it's...
Well, do you know, I'm glad we've had this conversation because I think I must have repressed a lot of this. I just remember feeling quite traumatised by Doctor Who with Tom Baker. And I watched it and sort of... Yeah, not. I mean, I wasn't too scared to watch it because I watched it, but then afterwards it was, not good.
No.
And I still can't watch it. And I'm sure it's not as scary now after what you said.
I mean, there's an awful lot of humour, and he brought so much to the role. But the fact is that he is quite mad, and that's what made him so good as a doctor, because he was alien. Yeah. You know, he doesn't fit into British, you know, society. It just doesn't fit into human society as a person, because he's so outrageous in his approach to life. Devil May Care, it made him a great doctor. He was just being himself.
He was, he was the best, in my opinion.
Still the best, yeah, totally, oh, totally.
You're going to get letters.
I actually have a Tom Baker scarf.
Did you knit it yourself?
No, I bought it from the Doctor Who.
An actual official one. Oh,
yeah. Wow. It wasn't cheap, but I had to have it. I love it.
Do you know the story of how that scarf came to be?
I bought it in the Doctor Who.
No, not that one. No, the original scarf. They apparently took an enormous amount of wool to a lady in, I think she was in Chiswick, and asked her to knit a scarf. And they said, well, you know, we want a reasonably long scarf. Anyway, she used all the wool. So it came out being over 17 foot long.
Oh, my goodness.
And as a result of it being 17 foot long, it would get snagged all the time. And gradually it got reduced to about 13 feet long, because about 4 feet of it got snagged on bits of set or rocks and Dartmoor or whatever else. And they had to cut bits off because it got shredded.
Yeah.
And so it gradually got short, and then they had to do another scarf later. But there was just her misunderstanding that they, you know, they've given her all these different types
to
of wool
from,
to create a multicolored scarf that's used absolutely every shred.
I love that. I've never heard that story. I love that.
Yeah. So that's
How long is your official Doctor Who scarf? Is it 17 feet?
We'll have to measure it, won't we?
It must be
wraps around about 4 or 5 times and then
must
drags.
Be good 8 or 9 feet, I would think.
And I do wear it in public. I do.
Of course.
Yeah. And I've always wanted a Tom Baker fedora, so that's
We have a sort of one, because my boys, they've dressed up as Tom Baker in the past with a brown jacket, my scarf, and then the hat.
Yeah. I wish I had his voice. That's the only thing I'd you know. Ah, yes.
You do have
the hair.
Voice.
The hair was fantastic.
The hair, everything.
Yeah, he was lovely. Yeah. Well, he still is lovely.
Yeah, totally mad. And the old boy is still going at 88. And he lives in Kent too.
Oh, does he?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
To look out for
him up.
Right, your neighbours. Well, April, look, it's been an absolute joy to speak to you. Thank you so much. I think there's so
I bet you didn't think we'd talk about Doctor Who, did you?
It wasn't on my list, but I'm glad we had that conversation. I'm feeling a bit better. It's been like therapy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, good luck with the books in with agents, or the book with agents and its follow-up. And that sounds like a really good concept, but it's been an absolute joy. And I think that, as ever with any of our interviews, we always get something, but there's so much depth to what we... all of our listeners will get from this. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's been brilliant. Thanks ever so much.
Really enjoyed that interview.
Me too. I enjoy them all.
Any chance to be Michael Caine? I'll take it. You know,
I wonder what the percentage of appearances of Michael Caine are in the 83 podcast.
Probably about a dozen.
What's that, 12? So that's what? Yeah. What's the percentage then? That was the question.
Oh, goodness me. Don't ask me. I mean, Jesus, I haven't got that sort of man. Where's Toby when you need it? Never mind. Well, look, we've got an exciting couple of weeks ahead for us, because we're taking a break. We're not actually stopping work. That's not the case, but we're going on holiday.
We're taking the work to Wales, is what he's trying to say.
To start with, for our first bit, and then we're off to Devon after that with your wider family, or our wider family. I don't know how to describe it. The boys,
well,
three
not
boys.
Very wide, so they're my immediate.
Yeah, the barn is moving, apart from the cat. To Devon at the end of next week.
Week
coming. So we're off to Wales briefly. What we're going to do with that time, well, I mean, a number of things, but we're going to spend a lot of time basically looking out for the next 6 to 12 months of what we're going to do.
Yes, and then we're going to paddle and eat chips on the beach.
Yeah, in that order. So that'll be great. That'll be fun. We've also got a busy August ahead, so we'll be, you know, working towards the release of 3 more Hobeck books.
I know, we've got a very busy August. I can't believe we're swanning off to the seaside. So we have 2 books publishing on 23rd of August. The wonderful Her Deadly Friend by Ray Sargent.
Yeah.
Now, Ray Sargent is an experienced writer of psychological fiction under her other name, Rachel Sargent. So this is, you know, it's a little bit of a departure for her, but there's a lot of psychological thriller in this book, isn't there?
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, there is.
Gets into the minds of the main character.
Yes, terrific. Yeah.
And of course, the other one is the second book in the Zamet series, Bullets in the Sand.
Yeah. The first one, Bodies in the Water, doing really well.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, I had a lovely, wonderful blog tour. It did, again. Yeah. A lot of people never come across A.G. Aberford before, but firm fans now saying, can't wait for the next one.
Well,
one,
so. You don't have to wait long for the third one as well, so that's coming out in
and
September.
And in fact, my dad read Bodies in the Water.
Oh, did he?
No, so my dad picks and chooses various Hobet books to read, and he always gives me very constructive feedback. He'll say what he likes, he'll say what he wasn't sure about, and he'll say what he doesn't like. He really liked Bodies in the Water.
Yeah, I love it. Well, I love them all, but, you know, Her Deadly Friend's great, and, you know, all the ones that we've released recently. I mean, every book that we've put out, I love. And the third of our August releases.
Right at the end of August, just at the bank holiday weekend, mm-hmm. we have Cousin Ash, which is the second in the Sandlin PI series.
By S.E. Shepherd.
Yeah, so a lovely book. The cover is beautiful.
Oh, it's a belter.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is one of Jane's tour de force designs, Jane Mapp. So thank you for that. Now, if you haven't seen the cover, just check it out.
It's on the website.
It's a beauty. It really is. They're all great. But August remains busy. We're going to be busy, you know, running up to the end of November, really. We're not going to release books in December, apart from our Christmas special.
Yeah, so we should give a bit of news about that very soon, because we've got a great idea. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we need to get our authors working on that.
Absolutely.
And you're not getting away with it, you know.
I know. I have to come up with a recipe. I'm going to experiment today. Listen, we ought to get to the question we're going to ask.
Yeah. So.
And the prize, first of all, to mention what that is, we'll give you a free download code for the first 10 people to answer this question, and this will be a download code for the audiobook of Throttled, which is the number 2 novel in the Quirk Files by A.B. Morgan.
Yeah, so if you didn't quite get there with Verity Vanishes, we had a lot of entries.
Oh, my word, we were swamped.
It was quite funny because I was sat at the computer and my phone, I don't normally have the volume on, but the volume was on because I was waiting for you to message me.
Of course.
And it was going ping, ping, ping constantly, to the extent that I turned it off and hid it. It was so much. But it was lovely talking to people, even the ones who hadn't quite got the first top 10.
It was lovely.
So we thought we'd do another one, but this time we wanted to do it on the podcast.
Okay.
So the inbox doesn't get flooded. Well, not quite so much. So what we'd like you to do is answer this question and email hobeckbooks@gmail.com with the answer. And the first 10 will get a free download of Throttled. And the question is, in Throttled, Pedder is trying not to swear, and he finds lots of alternative words to use instead, which a lot of people do, don't they? One such word that he uses is bummalo, B-U-M-M-A-L-O, bummalo. But what is a bummalo?
Sounds incredibly rude. Just remind me of that email address when people know what a bummalo is.
So email hobeckbooks@gmail.com.
Okay, wonderful. Well, that's an opportunity to get a free audiobook of Throttled, narrated by Alison Morgan herself. And she's done a terrific job on the series. Really, really good. So congratulations to her.
She did work very hard, didn't she, to get it all?
Absolutely. And Verity Vanishes came out last week, doing really well. So check that out as well. And all of our Hobeck authors and books, well, you can buy them all in paperback form from our website, www.hobeck.net, at a discount. You can get audiobooks there as a discount as well if you don't win. So check out that. We've got coming up for a dozen titles now in audio.
Well, the paperback said there's just no postage and packaging for the UK. That's the
That's the other advantage. Yeah. So do please consider visiting us there and finding out all about our authors and our books and all of our plans. Which will be significantly changed, I think, once we've had our chance to brainstorm for 3 days in a caravan. Whatever it is we're going to be doing while it rains. I know you looked at the weather for Borth, where we're going, in Mid Wales, for 2 nights, 3 days, and it is 100% chance of rain on every single day.
Yes, and I've been there many times as a boy, so give you a bit of context. My dad and my stepmom own a caravan in Borth, mm-hmm. so we're allowed to use it anytime it's free, and I've spent many a wet week there with 3 energetic children.
Yeah, well, they're not with us this time. Probably a good thing, but they're with us in Devon when we go off to North Devon. on Friday. So this coming Friday, we're looking forward to that trip enormously. But it's been a trip on this podcast. Thank you so much for joining us on the Hobcast Book Show. We ought to mention that we are working on the content for next week. It's going to have a Welsh theme, and we have a bid in for a particular author that we're really keen to speak to. But have no fear, the podcast will be back next week as usual. And so it remains for me to say, I'm Adrian Hobart.
I'm Rebecca Collins.
And we would like to thank you for joining us on the Hobcast Book Show. Please don't forget to subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts from. It means a great deal to us. But from me, Adrian Hobart, as I've already mentioned, and for you, Rebecca Collins, as you've already mentioned.
And Aki the cat, who's asleep upstairs.
And Aki the cat. Thank you for joining us and have a wonderful... I'm going to say something in a moment. And creative week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Hobcast from Hobeck Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hobeck online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.